Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, what is troubling the fishing waters between Senegal and the European Union? An international campaign to end corporal punishment in schools. Here's why Uganda did it more than 25 years ago.
The concern, of course, was children being punished by teachers, some of them to the extent of being maimed. There was a case of a child whose back was broken in the process of being punished and being paralyzed. There were cases also of other forms of violence in the name of punishment.
And millions of tourists flock to African countries for fun, fauna and flora. Guess which one this is?
It's got wildlife, it's got beaches, it's got islands, it's got the flora and fauna. And to top it all off, it's got the people. The people are exceptional. We are the home of hospitality.
And we know the people make the place. It's Thursday, the 14th of November. First, we go to Senegal. There is troubled waters between the European Union and Dakar at the moment because the EU has said it won't renew a five-year agreement to fish in the waters off the Senegalese coast. The EU says this agreement, which dates back to 2019 and expires at the weekend, has brought more than $9 million in revenue for Senegal. The EU also says it is cancelling because Senegal hasn't done enough to tackle illegal fishing practices. Senegalese fishermen are saying, funny that, foreign fishing vessels from countries in the EU have been fishing illegally, forcing small-scale farmers out of business. This is actually a long-standing complaint by fishermen up and down the West African coast. So Senegal might not be that bothered by this cancellation, actually. The renegotiation of the contract was part of the election campaign that was won by President Bassirou Diomaye Faye back in March. Ifesinachi Okafor-Yawood is a sustainable development lecturer at the University of St Andrews in Scotland. I asked her on what grounds the EU had decided to stop fishing in Senegalese waters.
I think this question is best answered by the EU. However, based on what I know, I think this is not really a case of deciding to stop fishing in Senegal because they are not meeting the terms of sustainable fisheries, which is one of the things that they have cited. You know, they've recently given Senegal a yellow card. But at the same time, what I can say is that the conversation has been ongoing in Senegal before now. For instance, the current president, during the times of his campaign, he strongly talked about the need to reevaluate the current fisheries agreement and other agreements around exploitation of their resources. After he won the election, or when he was re-elected in May, they talked about this again, about actually having an audit, including specifically auditing the fisheries agreement with the EU and their licensing agreement. So already we know that the government or the president is already poised to sort of renegotiate and ensure that at least the agreement that they enter into with entities such as the European Union or their licensing with countries like China, Russia and others is something that is beneficial to them. So it is possible that the EU is not actually willing to pay what Senegal is asking for. It is possible that the EU is not willing to reconsider the new terms that Senegal is floating. So unless the government of Senegal also comes out to say the reasons, we have to take it based on what we already know, which is basically that Senegal is not meeting the terms of sustainable fisheries, which is hinged on the yellow card that has been recently given.
Has this conversation been going on for years in Senegal? Because we know that Senegalese fishermen have been complaining that foreign vessels are responsible for overfishing in their waters, which then forces them to have to find another way of making a living.
Yes, the conversation around sustainable fisheries has been going on in Senegal for a very long time, and it's actually have increased in recent times. Previously, actually, there was a time when the conversation was so heightened in the early 2000s that Senegal also had to be the one to cancel its agreement with the EU because the population in early 2000 were actually complaining about the extent to which the agreement with the EU was contributing to depletion. And Senegal was actually the people that had to officially make the decision to not renew its agreement. So this is not the first time. The difference, however, is that this time we're hearing that the decision is coming from the EU. The reality is also that in general, that there is a limited capacity for so many countries in West and Central Africa, although this thing is improving in comparison to before, to monitor, control and survey the vessels that are operating in their waters. And therefore, with this limited capacity comes, unfortunately, opportunities for criminal-minded vessels and companies operating in this region to want to circumvent the law. And so we know that outside the European Union, for example, some of the other vessels that are also exploiting fisheries resources in Senegal have also been contributing to the depletion. And the long-term implication then is that the artisanal fishers, these are people that use the local boat, that rely on fishes for their livelihoods, and the men and the women that rely on the fishery sector for their livelihood are unfortunately not able to catch enough fish to make ends meet. I think maybe this is a point where I make things clear, that there are so many factors in today's world that are unfortunately exacerbating depletion. When we talk about the overfishing, when we talk about illegal and unreported fishing, when we talk about the impact of climate change, the expansion of port infrastructure, the development of the blue economy, and even now we're talking about blue energy generation, and so many of these factors all together exacerbate depletion, which unfortunately will mean that in the long term, unless something radically different is done to actually ensure sustainable fisheries, it is actually the artisanal fisheries that are going to bear the brunt of the implication, which would mean significant reduced catch for them.
So what does the EU say when Senegal points the finger back at them and says, but you are overfishing and your fishing, the fishing boats from your countries are causing a crisis in our waters and causing our young people to leave and to undertake perilous journeys because they can't make a living on the continent anymore?
Well, we see the EU's response in the form of the yellow card. It's basically saying the onus is on you, regardless of the potential responsibility we have, regardless of the fact that the EU actually have the more technical wherewithal to call their vessels in order. But also, the conversation have already been happening within Senegal, wherein they are thinking about reconsidering their agreement, the fishing agreement with the EU, before the current president was elected. After the president was elected, this conversation was heightened. So it is possible that the EU is not willing to pay, as part of this audit, to pay the terms that Senegal is trying to renegotiate for a fairer fisheries agreement, because it is no secret that the amount of money that they pay for this agreement a lot of the times is quite insignificant compared to the amount of a profit they make. But then it's a case of the lesser evil in that Senegalese fisheries sector is not that industrialized or developed to be able to exploit the fisheries resources by themselves. We also have had actually instances in the past where countries within the continent or the region have renegotiated their terms and gotten significant amount of money in comparison to what they had in their previous agreement. So, for example, the agreement between the EU and Guinea-Bissau expired in 2017. And although a lot of the official documents that you read, they cite that instability in the country stalled the agreement, by 2019, when the agreement was renewed, they were getting a substantial or significant amount of money more than the previous agreement that had expired. So it is quite probable, and we're not really getting this as the official news, that as well as the so-called concerns around the regulations and transparency within Senegal and their fisheries, that also the EU is not willing to pay the renewed amount that Senegal is trying to ask for.
So what I'm wondering is, what difference does it make to the EU if they don't have a formal agreement? Are there other ways in which fishing trawlers can still operate in West African waters off the Senegalese coast?
Well, actually, yes, there are other ways. And we've seen this in the past within the Gambia, where EU vessels or vessels from the EU have actually circumvented EU laws to go directly to make alternative arrangement, which obviously is also in contravention of the EU common fisheries policy. And they did that in the Gambia for a very long time until a report by Oceana exposed this. Oceana is a research institute that is based in the US, but it also have offices in UK and other parts of the world. And so this is actually a very dangerous thing for countries in the region, including Senegal, because one cannot necessarily see what would happen in that the existing loopholes in the system and the fact that vessels can almost always encroach in neighboring countries' water, given that there are no fences that demarcate the ocean. So the vessels that have license to fish in the Gambia, as there currently is, for example, might still be able to fish illegally in Senegalese water, even though that there is no longer a formal agreement.
So given that this conversation has been happening for a while, what I'm wondering is, if the EU then decides that it won't be licensing fishing in Senegal, in Senegalese waters rather, will that gap be filled by Chinese and Russian vessels?
Of course it's going to be filled, not even by Russian or other vessels. It will also be filled by EU vessels. I don't know if you are aware of, I know that there are many beneficial owners in countries like Ghana operating and posing as Ghanaian companies within the fisheries sector. In the Senegalese fisheries sector, there are beneficial owners that are linked to Spain and other entities in the European Union. So it would be easier for these people to circumvent whatever this so-called non-renewal of the agreement mean by maybe sort of going through the beneficial owners, setting up their companies within Senegal and sort of positioning themselves as Senegalese, because the law allows them to sort of invest together with local Senegalese companies. And then that can be a way of circumventing this. So actually, this is something that allows us to speak more about transparency or lack thereof and the use of power in politics in sort of, I don't want to use the term bully, but basically trying to use that to call people to order if you don't act. But the benefit of this also in terms of what could happen for Senegal is a free world, and there's an opportunity for them to renegotiate better terms with other countries or entities that might be interested in exploiting their waters. So you mentioned Russia, you mentioned China, and I'm sure South Korea as well, and other countries that might be willing to exploit fisheries in their waters. Would they also have to be willing to abide by the new terms, renegotiate the terms, and ensure that the money or the benefit that is in it for Senegal in terms of the financial remuneration is something that is worth it? Because currently the amount of money that they pay for this agreement, for this licensing, in comparison to what they take, is substantially lower.
That's Ifesinachi Okafor-Yarwood, a sustainable development lecturer at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. If you went to school back in the day when I did, corporal punishment was the norm. And that was long ago. But guess what? It still is. In fact, 2 in 3 children all over the world endure violent punishment, or discipline, as it's called, at home and at school. These are figures provided by the United Nations Children Agency, UNICEF. And that's not the only form of violence against children in supposedly safe environments. There's verbal aggression, belittling language, insults, all in the name of discipline. Spare the rod and spoil the child vibes. And we are not even talking about the violence children endure during war. It is heartbreaking. But leaders across the globe met in Colombia for the first annual global ministerial conference on ending violence against children recently. 8 countries promised to make laws to end corporal punishment in all settings. They include Burundi, The Gambia, Uganda, and Nigeria. We'll hear more from Uganda, which has long had a ban on hitting children in schools, but now intends to outlaw it everywhere. But let's listen to Dr. Etienne Krug, the director of the Department for Social Determinants of Health at the World Health Organization. He attended the conference.
67 countries have already banned it in the world by law. We want others to join. That requires, of course, adoption of legislation so that it is banned. It requires also, because we know just having a law is not enough, communication and education and awareness raising around the negative impacts of corporal punishment and also the alternatives that exist to corporal punishment in order to discipline children. We need to have a two-pronged approach. On one hand, ban it and make sure it doesn't happen, but also provide the alternatives, because, of course, sometimes we need to discipline children.
So what are the suggestions for disciplining children besides corporal punishment?
Totally. So we're not at all preaching that that should be the alternative. No, the alternative is, of course, a dialogue first, and then taking away privileges, I don't know, phone time or, things that the child enjoys, in order for the child to understand that discipline is needed. Over the years, we've been accumulating evidence of what works. We know what needs to be done. And we're approaching a deadline. 2030 is the deadline that governments had set in the Sustainable Development Goals to eliminate all forms of violence. And while we see some progress, it's way too slow.
Dr. Etienne Krug from the World Health Organization. Now back to Uganda, where corporal punishment in schools has been illegal for a while now. In fact, since 1997. But that doesn't mean it's stopped. Agri David Kibenge is the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Gender, Labour and Social Development. He was also at the conference in Bogota.
We made a number of pledges, including one of conducting a second national violence against children survey, in addition to the one that we had already done to generate more data. We also committed to amending ultimately the Children's Act of 2016 that bans corporal punishment in all settings. Corporal punishment was already banned in schools in Uganda and even in prisons as a form of punishment. But we still have work to do beyond the schools, within other institutions, the communities, the parents in the homes. That is where there's a lot of work to do. But also we committed to address negative social norms such as child marriage and female genital mutilation within a number of districts, rolling out the national family policy, implementing the national standards for parenting programs, and so many others, and fully integrating the child helpline into the mainstream public service. As a ministry, we established a child helpline, which we have even expanded to include matters of GBV, gender-based violence. So there were quite a number of pledges that we made. Of course, in these areas has already been going on, so we are not talking about something we are not committed to doing.
So Uganda banned corporal punishment in 1997 already. Tell us what was happening then that made Uganda decide to ban corporal punishment in schools, because very many countries were not even thinking about it, and very many countries still today would be resistant to that idea. What made the Ugandan government decide that hitting children in school was not acceptable?
At the time, I was personally working within the ministry responsible for education. And the concern, of course, was children being punished by teachers, some of them to the extent of being maimed. I think there was a case of a child whose back was broken in the process of being punished and being paralyzed. There were cases also of other forms of violence meted out against children in the name of punishment. So there was concern. And the focus then and still today was how to create safe schools, safe learning environment, aware that it is only under such circumstances that learning actually can take place. And school is one place where government around that time felt all children should be given an opportunity to access school.
So what was the reaction to that ban then, and how was it implemented? Were parents resistant to it?
They don't resist openly, because once government has issued a policy directive, Uganda is not like some of those other countries where parents will be that organized and probably even march in protest of policy or laws. So in this case, maybe you would judge from the response at homestead level, because even when children at school were supposed not to be punished, you still would get instances of parents that will go to school and even encourage the teachers and encourage the administration to punish their children and say, I'm the father, I'm the mother, and I'm instructing you to punish. Parents even go into schools and at times say, if the school cannot punish my kid, let me punish this kid myself in front of the other children, in front of everybody, so that he or she knows that I have authority over him. So there's that mindset that we still have to deal with.
Are there ways in which children and young people can report cases now to the authorities?
Yes, yes, yes. I talked about a child helpline, which we established. It's a free toll line that anybody in any part of the country, not only children, but any concerned person who sees children's rights being violated, including violence being meted against them, can call and report. As a ministry, we established that helpline. It operates 24 hours a day. And when we receive those calls or cases reported, we refer them to the nearest government authority for purposes of following up and intervening to ensure or to assure safety of the children.
But you think that that it's becoming less socially accepted for people to hit their children or for the education system to justify or sanctify the beating of children in schools?
There is still a lot of work to be done, because even in the schools themselves, where you think they know policy and ought to comply, there are still cases that you hear of children being punished using methods that are unacceptable. But I think the bigger task we have is educating society, educating communities, and emphasizing parenting that assures safety of the child. Punishing by caning or hazardous ways of punishment is something that is outmoded. And until parents realize the responsibility they have to their children, we still have a problem. So I can't say with certainty that because we have policy in place, because we have laws in place that enforce the banning of corporal punishment, that it has happened.
How does being assaulted in the school setting or at home, or violence against you as a child, how does it affect a child?
I know that the more a parent is violent, or anybody around a child is violent towards the kid, it creates stress, depression, it creates fear, and ultimately breeds violence. I mean, if you don't invest love and care into a child, and all he or she sees around him or her is simply violence, being barked at, being thrown about, how would you expect that when he grows up, he'll be different? And these are the challenges we are facing in contemporary times, where we want democracy in the world, but we have not even bothered to cultivate it in our homes, in our workplaces. We don't have that patience and tolerance. So if you invest violence, you reap violence.
Okay.
Okay, it's been my pleasure.
Bye-bye. Agri David Kibenge, who is with the Ministry of Gender, Labour and Social Development in Uganda. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Our amazing, beautiful continent is a dream destination for many visitors and tourists. They love the beaches, the forests, the animals, the mountains. And before COVID, millions went to places like South Africa, Mauritius, Botswana, Kenya, Tanzania, Rwanda, Namibia, Zambia, Ghana, and Senegal. Those are the top 10, by the way. But there's also Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, and many hidden gems like Sierra Leone, Madagascar, Eswatini, Uganda. I could go on because these are just the obvious places. But I should stop going on and just tell you that after COVID, numbers languished. The International Monetary Fund said tourism had become one of the most important sectors in the global economy, accounting for 10% of global GDP, providing more than 320 million jobs worldwide. That was before COVID. But after COVID, countries are still struggling to get the numbers of visitors back up again. And as my colleague Daniel Dzadzi found out, they made full use of a recent jamboree here in London to display their wares.
Audrey, from all over the world, there were dozens and dozens of countries. From Africa alone, I counted nearly about 20 different countries. And the way it was set up, whether there were different stands, for instance, in Egypt, there was a small pyramid where people would showcase what there is, give yourself a feel. I loved the Morocco stand where they set up a little like palace and there was a man serving Moroccan tea. I didn't know Moroccan tea was that sweet till I got there.
Well, you need to sit in the desert and drink Moroccan tea. And then you'll realize exactly how sweet it actually
is. Yeah, it was much cooler than a desert.
Well, because you were here in London. So what was your impression of the event? And why do you think it was being held? It seems like quite a serious push. Who had actually initiated it? Under which auspices was it being held?
So the World Travel Market is one of the largest tourism trade fairs in the world. And there were a number of big institutions behind us. For instance, the World Travel and Tourism Council, the head of UN tourism, tourism ministers, heads of government institutions in charge of promoting tourism. But there was also a large private sector presence, travel and tour agencies, airlines, people who are involved in a travel business, ready to do business, ready to market their wares.
So which ministers did you talk to and what are some of the things that they said to entice you, Daniel, to go and visit their countries? Or if you were not enticed, you know, tourists with deep pockets.
I'm definitely enticed at this point. I specifically spoke to the ministers of tourism from Malawi. Also spoke to the minister of tourism, Abdoulaye Diop, from Gambia. I loved Mr. Diop. He kept smiling. He said, Gambians love smiling. He said, go to the beach in Banjul. You're going to love it. But Vera Kakumtule of Malawi spoke very extensively about how Malawi is the one country that you can do in a day. So she walked me through a number of activities that will take you only hours. Hi, Vera. So tell me, what's the unique selling proposition for Malawi?
Thank you very much. The unique selling point for Malawi is the fact that we are a very tiny country, very, very small, and yet compact in diversity, and then as well as we are big on hospitality. What that means is that you are able to be to see the sunrise from one end of the country and see the sunset from another end of the country. But within 5 hours, you're able to see everything that tourism in Africa has to offer. So you have your wildlife, you have your mountains, you have the lake, you have everything, the beaches, everything. In 5 hours, you're able to do that in my country.
So if I were to land in Malawi today,
yes,
what's the first thing you advise I would do?
The first thing that you're going to do is you go to the lake. So it's about 1 hour from the airport. And this lake is very unique. It's called Lake Malawi, the 9th largest lake in the world.
I did not know that. Although I know a lot about Malawi, I've been there several times. And that lake is beautiful. It's like a small, angry sea.
So that was Vera Kamtukule. She is the Malawi tourism minister. Amazing woman, amazing country, from what I learned. She honestly convinced me on the spot. And she told me about all the different species of fish that you can find in the lake.
Oh, yeah. Delicious to eat. But you know what struck me about what she said there? She was talking about the country and the features of the country. What I miss when I hear ministers and African tour providers and, you know, promoters, they rarely tell you about the people of that country. And for me, when I go to a country, I actually really want to get to know the people.
That's an interesting point you raised there, because I also spoke to Nabila Tunis, who is Minister for Tourism for Sierra Leone, and her big selling point was the people.
Hi, Minister, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm very, very fine. So the first question we always ask, tell us in 3 words, what is Sierra Leone?
Authentic, beautiful, and natural. That's
authentic, Sierra Leone. Authentic, beautiful, natural. I love that. And expand on that for me a bit. What do you offer to the tourist?
We offer almost everything, I must say. Sierra Leone is one country that has everything in it. It's got wildlife, it's got beaches, it's got islands, it's got the flora and fauna, and it's got the history. And to top it all off, it's got the people. The people are exceptional. We are the home of hospitality. Sierra Leone, that's what it is.
So tell me one thing about Sierra Leone that people do not know, but they should know.
I think one thing people should know is that Sierra Leone's history and cultural heritage is really rich. Most people focus on the beaches. Most people also realize that, okay, yes, it's got a beautiful landscape. But one thing we don't really focus on is the diversity of our culture and our rich heritage that we have in that country.
So tell me one thing about this diverse culture and heritage that would blow me away if I came.
Well, if you come to Sierra Leone, you would find out that you will immerse yourself in the culture of the people anywhere you go. You will feel at home. And that's the value that we have as a country, the people. And you have this diversity that goes across the different regions. So whether you're in the north, the east, the west, or the south, you'll get a different experience. But the experience is so welcoming and beckoning that you'll never want to leave. So that is one thing that people don't know about Sierra Leone. When you speak about Sierra Leone, all they think about is the beaches, the mountains, but they forget to realize that we have the people to top it off. And that's the added value that we provide.
I'm so glad that Nabila Tunis highlighted the natural wealth that the people bring to a country. But how well do these tourist industries actually serve the people of those countries? Because I found that in very many African countries, the tourism industry is held in the hands of people who are not necessarily from that country. And secondly, if they are, they kind of, for me, almost reduce the rest of the population to service. You know, they are there to serve the people with the money that have come into the country. And they get treated in that way as well as just staff.
It's an interesting point that you raise, and there's actually data to back it up, Audrey. Data from the UN World Travel Organization or the World Tourism Organization mentioned that Africa receives only about 2.5% of international travel receipts as a share of global revenue. And so these are questions that are being raised both by leaders in the tourism industry and by the private sector stakeholders who come and do the investment. The question is, these private sector players come in with money to take advantage of, for want of a better expression, take advantage of the potential that is there to help raise the potential so that people can visit. And so the question really is, if you have the money, you can take full advantage. That's why the UN boss was telling me that as part of their agenda for Africa 2030, they are championing education so that they can be more skilled labor in the continent to take up some of these leadership roles, these management roles that you were talking about. There are also funds available for them to invest in businesses or startups on the continent, which can then take over these big hotel chains and tourist management facilities.
So let's take a little look at some of the challenges that the tourism industry faces.
Yeah, I think that you already touched on one of the big ones. That is the fact that a lot of the investment comes in and not all the funds can stay. But one big challenge that we discussed with some of these policymakers and stakeholders was ease of travel within the continent. Because if you notice, a lot of travel that happens within Europe and within America, for instance, is by citizens of Europe, citizens of America. They are the ones who use domestic tourism to improve upon their facilities and to invest in their facilities. Now, the AFDB found in 2023 that for 46% of country-to-country travel within Africa, a visa is required, compared to somewhere like the EU, where even if you're visiting from elsewhere and you have a Schengen, you can cross borders on a bus, on a train, whichever way that you want. And so the UN Tourism has been talking about a single Africa air travel market, which they're supposed to champion. They've set a goal of 7 to 10 years of seeing what people call a borderless Africa, an Africa that is easier to travel through. But there are also huge cost barriers in terms of traveling from country to country. It's far more expensive to travel from Ghana to Nigeria than it is to travel from the UK to France. And if you look at distance, it's not too different. Of course, it's a bit longer than the UK and France, but it's not too different. So these are issues that they're going to have to talk about on a policy level. But there's a lot of confidence in the African Continental Free Trade Area to ensure, because a lot of tourism is also business tourism. It's not just leisure tourism.
And medical tourism.
And medical tourism, where countries like Tunisia, for instance, are taking quite a lead. And so with the AFCFTA, it's believed that it will be championed and some of these prices will be made more reasonable for regular people.
So I think I know the answer to this, but I'm testing you. What's the most popular tourism destination in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, sub-Saharan Africa, I was ready to say Africa. Africa is Egypt. Sub-Saharan Africa, I must come back, but I will say Kenya.
Wrong. Well, I think it's wrong. I think it's actually South Africa and very specifically Cape Town. It's one of the 10 top tourist destinations in the world.
In the world currently. Yeah, I mean, this is one that I'm sure I'll say it here because I'm sure we'll make it to the final cut. If it does do, yes, I'll take you up on that.
Well, you want to go to Cape Town?
Cape Town. I definitely must visit Cape Town before I die.
Do you know what? As a South African, I can tell you right now, mm-hmm. you really don't have to, but you must visit Joburg.
I know how you're saying that because
I'm from Joburg.
Also, most South Africans tell me that like Joburg is like more, it gives you more of a feel of the people that you want to get in touch with. Like the South African culture is felt more in Joburg as opposed to Cape Town, which is more set up for visitors.
Yeah, I can go with that. But where do you want to go?
You mean on the continent or in South Africa?
No, on the continent. I'll stop being self-centered now.
I must say, Malawi made a strong case in that interview that I did. But I've always held a soft spot for Dakar.
I want
to see Dakar as well.
Yeah, Senegal is amazing. And it doesn't sell itself as a tourist destination. But you're not wrong about Malawi. It is gorgeous.
Mm.
It really is. Daniel Dadzi from the Focus on Africa team. Focus on Africa was built by the efforts of Nyasha Michelle, Joseph Keane, and Sunita Nahar. Carney Sharp was at the helm of it all as senior producer. Nick Randell was the technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. Before I go, you can catch us on air, in the podcast, and on YouTube as well. Our podcast, Africa Daily, offers you a long look into other matters affecting the continent and its peoples. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.